So as a practicing appraiser, we have lots of rules, right? We have rules, guidelines, suggestions, assignment conditions. I'm getting a headache, right? Let's talk about it. We have USPAP. That's your minimum, your bare bone minimum requirements. And I want you to understand that, ladies and gentlemen, that's not a suggestion or best practices or a guideline. That's a requirement. You have to adhere to USPAP, unless, of course, there's a jurisdictional exception. Another whole conversation there. We've got Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines, if applicable. We have FHA requirements, if you're doing an FHA. And, of course, we have all these laws. Can't forget law, right? We've got state laws we have to deal with on a regular basis. We've got federal laws we have to deal with. We have the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, commonly known as Dodd-Frank. Oh, my gosh. We've got FIREA, the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act of 1989. I think I got that right. Now I'm getting a headache. Well, I have a special guest on the program. You're not going to want to miss it. We're going to talk about all these rules and guidelines and requirements and how you can navigate those and stay out of trouble. You're not going to want to miss this one. Come on back. Hi, this is Brian Reynolds. You're listening to the Appraisal Update Podcast, brought to you as always by the great people over at Appraiser eLearning. You need some education? Check us out at appraisereLearning.com. I'm super excited. I have a special guest today, Mr. Jeff Morley. He is the chair of the Utah Appraisers Licensing and Certification Board, a practicing appraiser, just a really great guy. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm excited to be here with you.
So if there's anybody, you know, I told them a little bit about you, but you're a certified general appraiser. You're still a practicing appraiser. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I've got report to write after we're done chatting.
Very good. Well, why don't you take just a couple of minutes and let my listeners know a little bit more about Jeff Morley?
Well, I can't profess for that to be my favorite topic, but happy to give you a brief summary. Like you said, Brian, I'm a practicing appraiser. I've got a lot of experience in the commercial and the residential space, both. I am an MAI and an SRA with the Institute. About 7 years ago, I was asked to serve on our Appraiser Licensing and Certification Board. It's been a really good experience. Probably one of the biggest takeaways for me is a realization that everybody serving on those boards are just mere mortals. I mean, none of us are flawless or perfect, but trying to do, you know, the best that we can to uphold public trust and make sure that we have good actors, you know, in the space there. Having interacted with more than just my appraisal board, I've seen that the makeup of different boards varies quite a bit from one state to the next, from, you know, being fully positioned or staffed to, you know, some not. Attitudes and perspectives change. And I've even seen that evolve a little bit on our board based on the personalities that roll on and off of the board over time. So been a great experience for me, for sure.
Yeah. So let's just jump right in, right? I mean, it's probably one of the biggest fears for a practitioner is I remember when I first started out, I was scared to death. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I was officially an appraiser, but I was stumbling around. And I remember the first time I got a call from the Kentucky Real Estate Appraisers Board. I mean, I was scared. Oh, my God. Larry Disney's on the phone. What'd I do? Oh, no. You know, and I pick up the phone, and he's wanting me to do some research for him in the local market here. And I'm like, whew, you know. Now I get a call from the board. And I'm like, what do you want? You know, I just, you know, I live my life. We can't live in fear, but a lot of appraisers do. They're terrified of these boards. And I get it. You know, the boards are there to regulate us. That's the job. That's the job of the regulatory board, is to regulate us. But let's talk about it a minute. On the complaints that you folks get in, what would you say, and I'm not holding you to be exact, Jeff. I know you have no idea what I'm about to ask you. But on average, how many of the complaints actually have merit that when your investigation is completed, you find that the appraiser actually had some wrongdoing here versus how many are really just frivolous complaints of a homeowner mad or, you know, a seller mad because it messed up their deal?
Well, that's a really good question, Brian. In part because we only see as the actual board, I would estimate a small percentage of the total complaints that actually get, you know, submitted to the state. I know that states will handle this differently from one to the next, but for us, our division staff has a screening process that they will go through. And so something that appears to have no merit, no, you know, basis in an actual USPAP violation that may be, you know, warranted, many will be dismissed. I know attending the last AERO conference, one of the hot topic items were tip letters and referrals from, you know, from Fannie Mae that were being generated and sent in. And frankly, it was interesting to hear how states are struggling to know how to address those. Some states, you know, handle them differently. Some won't even look into them if they're not on the right form and signed by an individual. Others are opening a case on every single one, at least with some of the feedback I was getting. Our state is, you know, just kind of going through their typical screening process on those. So, you know, the first step is to screen those from what we see. So, you know, from what actually goes from a screening to an investigation to then coming before the board, I don't have exact numbers, obviously, but it seems to me that it's a relatively small percentage that actually end up going through the entire process there.
So in your particular state, if let's just say a licensee in your state had a complaint filed, there's a good chance if it was a disgruntled property owner and got mad because they thought the value was higher than what the appraiser opined, there's a good chance that that wouldn't ever even cross the desk of the board. It would be handled prior to the board ever seeing that. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate statement. And that gets screened and addressed by the division staff. And I think that's probably an important note just to make for listeners is that you've got the staff, at least for us, we've got division staff that will receive and screen, and then even the investigators are on staff. The board members are the review or the volunteer, you know, the volunteers that fill that position, but don't interact with the day-to-day operations of what the division staff is dealing with. So when there are questions, when there are decisions to be made, it's kind of a, you know, a quasi decision-making or judicial, you know, board in the sense that decisions are made, but we're not the investigators that are doing the investigation initially. And so I've seen some where a disgruntled homeowner in the scenario you laid out filed a complaint because they just knew the value of their property was a lot higher than this, you know, silly appraiser came up with. And sometimes those will go into at least the investigation phase where the division will contact the appraiser. They will ask for work product and work file. Oftentimes, if the sole basis of the complaint is just value and there aren't obvious, you know, USPAP violations that stand out as they go into the investigation, there will be a dismissal at that point. So from those that make it through screening, through an investigation, then to actually coming before the board is a small percentage. I'm confident of that.
Yeah. You know, that's actually quite refreshing because we as appraisers, we have a tough job, and I've always said, you know, we're kind of like an umpire. You know, if I make a call and you like it, then you love me. But if I make a call, he's out, and you don't like my call, I'm the devil, right? You hate me. And I've always said, in a lot of these instances, when a consumer, a homeowner files a complaint because the appraiser they feel was lower than, and I know there's probably some cases that have some validity there, but to me, that's almost like, well, the appraiser probably were doing their job, you know, because the easy thing to do would be, well, I'm just going to make everybody happy, right? And I'll never get a complaint filed. And that's the wrong attitude. You're not adhering to the definition of an appraiser when that happens. So that's kind of refreshing that some of these don't even get up to you. But let's take it the other extreme. Let's take it to the other extreme where the complaint does appear to have merit. It goes through the investigative process and it gets to the board. Out of those cases, what percentage do you think is really, really, really bad. I mean, it looks like, you know, the appraiser made up sales or you know, really, really is a bad character here. What percentage of those do you find?
Yeah, also a really good question. And I will just observe that there is kind of an intermediary step that in our state, for whatever reason, we see happen as often as not. And that's a stipulation where the appraiser will stipulate or agree to something with the investigator rather than go to a formal hearing. We probably receive as many, maybe more of those than even cases where, you know, that come before the board and that we hear. And so oftentimes it will be something like the appraiser acknowledges that they missed some steps or, you know, missed something, whether it was a transfer history or, you know, whatever's, you know, being called out by the investigator. And so they then therefore agree to some level of education, oftentimes a small fine or something. In side note, I guess, or maybe just on that topic, is interesting. We had one case that came, or a stipulation that came before us, and frankly, as the board discussed it, felt like it was probably a little bit heavy-handed, meaning that the appraiser agreed to something that they probably didn't need to, or we felt was onerous. And so it was, and this, you know, I don't expect happens very often, but we actually rejected the stipulation. And then the investigator went back and renegotiated something that was a lower fine than what had been agreed to initially. I imagine that was an interesting conversation that they had with the appraiser. Kind of good news, bad news here. Your stipulation's been denied. How do you feel about maybe paying a lower fine or something? I mean, not something that happens very often, but we try to be fair-minded, which I think is worth pointing out. And you know, just as we weighed all the facts of the case, felt like it doesn't seem like the punishment fits the crime in this case. And so they ended up getting less than what they'd agreed to initially.
Well, that's great. Kudos to your board. I tip my hat to that. That's like me negotiating with you to buy your car. And I say, I'll give you $10,000. And you say, why don't we make it $7,000 today, bro? Okay, let me stroke you a check. Yeah, I was going to give you 10, but if you'll take 7, great. So just so the listeners have a good, clear, critical understanding of this, when Jeff's talking about a stipulation, right, some folks call it an agreed order, right? There's different terms for this, but it's kind of like a plea bargain. Is that a good analogy, Jeff? I mean, you're kind of agreeing to accept something in lieu of going in front of the board for an actual hearing. Is that pretty much it?
That's right. Yeah. And I think I appreciate you pointing that out. I'm sure that there are different terminologies, you know, that are used in what's formally agreed to or the way it's presented, you know, when it goes to the board. And it does still go to the board for approval. But yeah, that's exactly right. It's kind of an acknowledgement that, yeah, I probably missed the boat on something. I'm okay as the appraiser just agreeing to, you know, whatever the punishment is and then just moving forward, as opposed to going before the board, having the hearing, and then the outcome is up to the board, but it could potentially be. And I think the reason appraisers agree to it is they feel like, I know I can live with whatever we're agreeing to here. I don't know if the board's going to impose something more severe. You know, is my license in jeopardy? You know, those sorts of things. And to answer the other part of your question, before I kind of diverted on the stipulation piece, I would say of those that have actually not stipulated, but that have come to the board, less than half of what I've seen have been really egregious. Now, they have been, you know, investigated and kind of gone through the process. And, you know, we had one that stands out where the appraiser was claiming to have done things that they clearly had not done. It, I mean, just in kind of broad terms, it involved a complaint on an FHA appraisal where there was a trainee involved. And the trainee shows up and does the inspection. The appraiser signs on the left certification as though they were the ones there. And then as we have the hearing, you know, it was kind of interesting how it unfolded, because initially as the state's attorney was making their case, they were talking about the appraiser having a ladder and the height of windows off of the ground. And as a board, I mean, I was sitting there thinking, where is this line of questioning even going? Like, why are they asking this? Well, it turned out that as the case proceeded, that the appraiser was saying, well, yeah, my trainee was there, but I also complied with the scope of work, you know, by completing an interior and exterior inspection of the property, because, you know, even though this was a refinance transaction, I went by after the fact, and with my ladder, I looked through the windows of this second level or second story, you know, and that's how I inspected the interior of this property. You know, and we're, it was almost a little insulting. You know, we're sitting there thinking, you really expect us to believe that on a refinance transaction where somebody's living in this property, you just showed up at a different time with your windows or with your ladder to look through the windows of this second story, and nobody, you know, had a concern with that, you know. So in cases like that, I mean, it's kind of a humorous story at how, you know, pathetic the scenario was. In that case, we took, you know, fairly punitive action, I thought, you know, because it was clear that the appraiser was not only, you know, just not honest about what they did, but trying to cover it up and not just acknowledge, look, I dropped the ball, shouldn't have done that. And so, you know, cases like that, I feel like are worth taking a pretty hard stand. What I see the vast majority of the time, though, and kind of to your point earlier, Brian, is most of the time the appraisers want to do a good job. They intend to do a good job. They're not trying to be misleading or fraudulent. They've made an honest mistake. And so our approach has generally been, let's educate, let's fix the problem and move on. The public trust isn't harmed by somebody who's made a mistake that's learned from it and moved forward. It probably is by somebody that would willfully misrepresent what they've done. And you know, they're not a reason to believe that they're, you know, seeing the error of their ways and correcting their action going forward.
I mean, we do have an ethics rule we're supposed to adhere to, right? So, you know, if you do, I mean, just fess up, tell the truth. It's going to be easier on you if you just, you know, I made a bad decision here. I'm sorry. I won't ever do it again. I had a student one time show up at the last minute. Obviously, he wasn't on the roster. He was a walk-in, and that's fine. Well, he needed his certificate really, really quick. And, okay, well, you were a walk-in. I don't have one prepared for you, but we'll send you one. Come to find out, Jeff, this guy took a picture of another student's certificate, whited out the name, and handwrote his in and sent it into the regulatory board. And they had contacted me and said, hey, don't tell students to use whiteout. I'm like, I haven't owned whiteout in 20 years, okay? And come to find out, he said that I told him to do that. Then he said I did it, and his story kept changing. And long story short, the board ended up launching an investigation on this, and the guy just kept lying. And the executive director of that particular state regulatory board said, if he had just admitted to it, probably nothing would have happened to him. But he just continued to lie. And then he got, you know, a buddy of his that was a representative call and try and get it dismissed. And that just made things. They ended up taking this guy's license. And it wasn't for what he did. He was in class the whole day. You know, he didn't have to do that, all to try and avoid a $200 late fee. And then he just continued to lie about it. And it just snowballed. And the board, one board member recommended $1,000 fine and suspension for 6 months. And he couldn't get a second. And the other board member said, no. This is an ethical issue. If he's lying to us, what else is he doing? So not a good plan. And so for crying out loud, don't say that you went to the subject property if you didn't. That's a lie. Right. So don't do that. So I want to get into some more of this in just a minute, Jeff. And boy, I could keep you here all day. And I know I don't have that luxury, but let me give a shout out to my sponsor real quick. Talk about getting in trouble for crying out loud. If you need some protection, and we all need protection, let's just face it. Right. Even if your case gets dismissed, it's not something you want to try and tackle alone. So since 1978, LIA Administrators and Insurance have been offering E&O insurance to valuation professionals. They provide superior customer service, exceptional liability education, and simply unparalleled claim defense. They've served over 10,000 real estate professionals all across the United States. LIA offers commercial bond, general liability, and cyber liability, and so much more. Check them out at liability.com to learn more about what they have to offer and how they can protect you. Thank you, LIA, for your continued support of the Appraisal Update podcast. We certainly appreciate it. So, Jeff, time's slipping away fast, and you've agreed, and I'll just let my listeners and viewers know, Jeff's going to come back at the end of November. So we're going to schedule a webinar where you can ask Jeff Morley some questions, right? So it will be on YouTube. So you need to jump over to our channel on YouTube. Do it right now and hit subscribe. That way you'll be notified when this thing comes out. Go to YouTube, search Appraiser eLearning, and hit the subscribe button. So on November the 30th at 10 o'clock Central Standard Time, we'll have the Appraisal Report webinar. And it will be broadcast live at 10 a.m. Central Standard Time. And you can type in questions and we'll get to as many questions as possible. And I think, Jeff, we're going to go over a real case, right? Maybe a real case, what happened, what maybe your recommendations are for the appraiser to do different things to maybe a different outcome would have occurred. So we're really looking forward to that. Thank you for agreeing to do that. So that in mind, let's talk about some of the common mistakes you see. You know, you've said probably most of the cases fall in between, you know, someone that didn't do anything wrong and it's dismissed versus someone that's, you know, maliciously doing things they shouldn't be doing. The majority probably falls in the middle of those two extremes. So give some example where maybe you have an appraiser trying to do the right thing, doing a great job, but did they adhere to USPEP? No, they didn't. Maybe it's a technicality. Maybe it's something they missed. What, give us some examples of some of the common errors so my listeners can make sure they're not doing any of those.
Yeah, make sure they're better than the common or the average. Well, one other thing that we do on a fairly regular basis with the way our state works is we have a fair number of experience hearings where a trainee or a licensed appraiser is applying to upgrade their license, either become licensed or certified, and their experience has been rejected by our review committee. So they'll appeal before the board. And that's where we see probably the vast majority of kind of these common issues as somebody's, you know, newer in the process, learning their way through. One of the biggest ones I see consistently, and I think it's probably because there's some confusion around it, is that around work file and what should be in a work file and when they're asked by the state to provide their work file. Now, obviously that can apply in cases where there's an investigation. Also, when experience is being requested, you know, they ask for a copy of the final report that was submitted along with the complete work file. And so often as we're going through, especially those experience review hearings, because we've had more of those than formal investigations of late, you know, the board has an opportunity to talk with or ask the applicant, you know, so talk to us about how you came up with, you know, whatever the conclusion is in the report, a site value, an adjustment rate, you know, things along those lines. And the probably most common issue that we see is we'll ask, you know, so how'd you come up with your GLA adjustment, for example? And there's not a great explanation. There's not any data or documentation in the work file that may support, you know, what that is. Site values are another one where, you know, you can look at land sales if they're available. You can look at allocation. You can look at extraction. You know, there are other methods as well. They'll oftentimes know the word to say, well, I did paired sales for that adjustment. Okay, so where are the paired sales or you know, what did they tell you about this adjustment? How do we know that it's, you know, the $60 a square foot that you're applying or whatever it is? Or, you know, okay, so you said you did extraction to come up with your site value of $80,000. Where's the data or like how, where did that $80,000, you know, come from? And beyond kind of the textbook answer of, well, you get site value by, you know, extraction or allocation or, you know, sales if they exist or whatever, they're not connecting the dots to then actually having that where that they can point to. And it's oftentimes a bit of a revelation to them. And, you know, in part because sometimes the training is subpar. It's not what's part of the practice of the supervising appraiser. It's eye-opening. And a lot of times they come away realizing, oh, like I guess part of the reason for my work file is that I can actually support, you know, the conclusions that I've drawn in the report itself. And they just don't, in spite of the qualifying education, they just don't always connect those dots in practice. And that's probably the single biggest issue that we see, you know, consistently from one to the next.
Yeah, I was just having a conversation with my buddy, Jason Covington, you know, Jason, buddy of mine, and a regular speaker. And and he helped us on a project. And I was telling him, I said, you know, I'll ask Kelsey, who could be certified now, and she will be soon. She's been an associate appraiser for 3, going on 4 years. She knows her stuff. She's very analytic, does a fabulous job. And I'm like, yeah, I remember one time I'm like, let me see your land sales. Where'd you get, you know? And I said, she brings me in 14 land sales. They're all weighted. Not all of them were weighted, but they were weighted. And the ones she didn't weight, she explained why. And when she gave X amount weight for this one, she explained. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, okay, I don't have any more questions. And Jason says, she just did that on one of mine. He said, I was looking at it, and I'm like, all righty then. He said, there's no way to refute that. You may have a different opinion, but the data is just overwhelming. And I'm like, yeah, I want her helping me in every case, right? So it's just real refreshing to see that data and see those steps that she took to develop that opinion, and not just say, okay, well, here's 2 land sales and I'm somewhere in between, right? Or paired sales analysis, well, where are they? I don't know. I don't know what I did with them. Yeah, that doesn't cut it anymore. So what are you still finding issues with, like highest and best use support and rationale for that? Are you finding issues with the use of extraordinary assumptions and hypotheticals? I know we're seeing those on a regular basis.
Yeah, great questions there. Yes, on the highest and best use, not as much as maybe we had seen in the past, but still definitely there. And part of it is, as you well know, that the challenge with the lending forms is there's a box to check. There's not right. really a great built-in area. So the appraiser just has to be intentional about talking about the highest and best use. And oftentimes, you know, it's not something that we're fining people for, but oftentimes if I'm making an existing property subject to repairs of a certain deferred maintenance, you know, kind of by definition, the highest and best use is to repair those items, but it's easy for the appraiser to forget to address, you know, some of those types of issues when just thinking through what is the highest and best use of this property as improved. Well, it's to fix the deferred maintenance, you know, and it's easy to have kind of a canned statement that doesn't get edited or thought about maybe as well as it should. One of the areas that we see oftentimes, you know, a problem is either reconciling a prior transfer of the subject property and the current value, or even just an analysis of a transaction generally. I mean, you know that USPAP says you have to report and analyze transactions, listings, offers. Appraisers are pretty good at, and unless the, you know, usually that's an honest oversight. In the past, we saw fraud where people weren't, you know, intentionally right. were not disclosing a listing or a prior sale at half of what they were appraising it for. We haven't right. seen that kind of a thing come up, you know, in a long time. But I think this falls more in the realm of, you know, kind of the honest mistakes, but that they're not stating that this property sold 6 months ago. Well, they'll state that it sold 6 months ago, but they won't analyze, was it an arm's length transaction? I'm now appraising it for more. Well, it's been remodeled in the meantime. There's a perfectly legitimate reason that the value today is different than it was 6 months ago, but they just don't connect those dots or tell the story. They paid $300 for it. They spent $50,000 remodeling it. I'm appraising it now for something more than the $300. That's an easy case to make, and it just adds to the credibility of the report. But that's where we, so you know, that's pretty regular. We'll see a deficiency in that line.
So. Listeners, viewers, don't simply say the subject property sold 2 years ago for $150,000, period. Because there's no analysis there. You're not reporting the result. All you're doing is making a factual statement. That's all. You're telling us it sold for $150,000 2 years ago, but there's more to the story. We need to know that you analyzed that prior sale and what the results of that analysis. So maybe you should start a sentence that says something like an analysis of the prior sale. Okay, now you're going to fill in the blank there. An analysis of the prior sale of $150,000 revealed. What did your analysis reveal? It was not an arm's length transaction, as it sold from, you know, a father to a son, and wasn't indicative of the market value. Okay, perfect. Thank you. But don't just give me a statement of fact that it sold 2 years ago for 150. That's not good enough. You're not answering the question that you're required to answer via Standard Rule 15B. So Great stuff, Jeff. Thank you so much for being here. Time's slipping away quickly, but I do want to ask you a couple more really quick questions. When we talk about best practices, and really USPAP is not best practices, USPAP is your bare bone minimum requirement. So it doesn't matter how I would have handled something. It doesn't matter how Jeff would have handled something. It doesn't matter how the board members would have handled it. The question is, did you as a practicing appraiser meet the bare bone minimum requirements of USPAP? But let's talk about steps that you could be proactive in making sure that you do adhere to those minimum requirements, right? What ideas or suggestions, let's face it, we can all be accused of wrongdoing at any time. So if you haven't had a complaint, there's a good chance if you're in this business long enough, you might get a complaint filed against you. Jeff, what couple of ideas can you give the listeners as to what they could do to prepare in advance of that complaint?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Ryan, there are a lot of things, as I've kind of thought through this, that come to mind. You know, one is having peers that you can interact with. You know, if you work in an office where you've got other appraisers, you know, readily available, don't be shy. I mean, talk to each other. Many appraisers, you know, that work independently or on their own, there are lots of ways to be able to connect with other peers to understand, you know, how would you handle this? Have you ever come across this kind of an issue? Properties in this and subdivision seem to be selling for a lot more. I'm not sure why. Have you ever come across that? There are some mechanisms or avenues to be able to ask those questions, even if you are a sole practitioner. That there are associations that are immensely valuable, through NAA and the local state associations, the Appraisal Institute. There are lots of groups where you can connect with, you know, call them friendly competitors or whatever you will, to kind of consult or get thoughts on how you might go about tackling something that could be a little bit challenging and may have a higher likelihood of, you know, somebody not being happy with the result when it's all said and done. There's kind of related to that effort, I've been listening to the Clubhouse connections on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Fridays. And in fact, just this week, you know, an appraiser was at a property on site, had a question about a roof, you know, via an attic inspection. And there were a whole bunch of people there able and willing to chime in or at least share perspectives. I would caution against putting too much stock in what you hear and see on Facebook groups. I've seen a lot of poor advice there that I wouldn't follow myself. Being able to either decipher or have a trustworthy group of peers is certainly valuable and important. And then maybe the last thing is talk to market participants that are out there. As appraisers, you know, we kind of hunker down and do our reports and kick them out the door. But don't be afraid to talk to real estate agents, to those that are interacting and dealing with buyers and sellers on a daily basis. They may not have as strong of analytical skills in some respects as appraisers should have, but they're talking with the market participants day in and day out. They know what they value and what they care about. And so, you know, I hear appraisers sometimes that think, well, I can't talk to an agent. I can't be influenced adversely on this, you know, on this assignment that I'm doing or whatever. And, you know, yeah, they can't threaten your oldest child if you don't give them a number they want, but you can certainly ask them, you know, what were your buyers thinking when they made this offer? How are buyers valuing this? What are sellers looking for? You know, I mean, there's lots of that kind of stuff that should be going on a regular basis, you know, to be dialed into your local market. So those are a few thoughts that come to mind to help have the best support, the best understanding of the market that you can in the event that there is a complaint filed. I know there are those that offer services to review your appraisals and your work product that, you know, where you can kind of preemptively, and I kind of think of it as, you know, turning to friendly fire saying, hey, help me get better, as opposed to it gets turned into the board and it's a little bit less friendly fire where the state investigators, you know, asking the same questions or giving that same level of feedback. And so we've done that, you know, directly and personally, where we've consulted with, you know, with reviewers and said, tell us where we're weak, tell us where we can be better. So I would definitely advise, you know, kind of a proactive approach to, you know, what is a random report that I did 2 months ago? How does it measure up, you know, to the standards that are out there? And any one of us can do something a little bit better, I have no doubt. So, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds mm-hmm. of things, I think, can help you be at the very top of your game. You can't avoid a complaint being filed. If somebody doesn't like a number, they can file a complaint. What the state does with it is out of your hands. but the ability that you have to defend and support what you've done is fully within your control. And so I would say be very proactive in being able to answer what you did and why, and have market support for it. And in almost every case, you'll be just fine.
Jeff, thank you so much for being here. I mean, I knew you're a busy guy, and I love the fact that this conversation's been more about trying to help appraisers and talk about things you could do to improve. You know, when I was running races and doing a triathlon and stuff like that, it was all about, you know, yeah, we're all competitive, right? Most human beings are competitive. But the cool thing about that is you're looking, oh, did I get a PR here? My personal record, have I improved my own time? And that's what it's about, just trying to improve, because we can all improve, no question about it. And so I appreciate you coming on today, not from the perspective of appraisers are doing this and this and this and this, and appraisers need to stop doing this, 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 right? You're coming more from the approach of, let's all improve. Let's try and do a little better. Let's try and find ways to avoid getting in that hot seat. And if we do get in the hot seat, we're prepared. We're prepared to answer those tough questions. So thank you for being here today. If someone wants to reach out to you directly, Jeff, what's a good way for someone to get in contact with Mr. Jeff Morley?
Yeah, appreciate that, Brian. I'm on LinkedIn. Not hard to find there. Aren't too many Jeff Morley appraisers that I've seen. Email address, jmorley, M-O-R-L-E-Y, at Accurity, Accurity.com. Always happy to field questions, to connect with people, to share perspective. I don't claim to or feel that I know it all or I'm the best appraiser in the world, but certainly strive to get better, and certainly happy to share the perspectives that I've had, you know, through the course of my career.
Very good. Thanks again, Jeff, for being here. I certainly appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Appraisal Update Podcast, brought to you as always by Appraiser eLearning and with support of our fine fellows over at LIA Administrators and Insurance. We certainly appreciate their continued support. Don't forget, Jeff's coming back. Jeff will be here on November the 30th at 10 o'clock Central Standard Time for an hour. I get him for a full hour on that day, and it's going to be broadcast live, so you can actually watch live and you can be part of the conversation. That's what I love about our webinars. It's called the Appraisal Report Webinar, and it will be broadcast on YouTube. So jump over to YouTube, subscribe right now, and you'll be in the know. 10 o'clock Central Standard Time on November the 30th. Until next time, be safe. Have a lot of fun out there. Take a break. Make some money. And happy appraising.
The Appraisal Update Podcast is brought to you by Appraiser eLearning.